doesn't that just mean when the Republicans, if it swings back, they'll add three more justices and this just continues forever?
Man, so, you live in San Diego now.
Is that what you were talking about on the 17th green?
Just enjoy your plain oatmeal, man. From Topic Studios and WarnerMedia Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm Debbie Kamau Bell.
And I'm future Nobel laureate Hari Kondabolu.
Again, we're two comedians trying to make sense of American politics.
During a pandemic, with children and anxiety.
And wildfires. And that means talking to the people doing the big work for our democracy.
We'll start by talking to Cori Bush.
A pastor, a nurse, and a Black Lives Matter activist, she knocked out a 10-term incumbent in this year's Democratic primary in Missouri's 1st Congressional District.
He talked about my evictions. You know, he talked about those things as a disqualifier, you know, for me going into the seat at a time when millions of people have lost jobs and people have lost homes and all of that at a time. So that's a disqualifier, he felt. He was that disconnected.
She's now poised to become the first Black woman to ever represent Missouri in Congress and got a special shout out at the Republican National Convention from that nice St. Louis couple who waved guns and threatened BLM protesters outside their house.
That same Marxist activist won the Democrat nomination to hold a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. In the city of St. Louis, that's the same as winning the general election. That Marxist revolutionary is now going to be the congresswoman from the 1st District of Missouri.
Ah, Marxist, the new leftist. And after we talk to Cori Bush, we'll bring on John Lovett.
He's the co-host of Pod Save America, the podcast that's been described as the liberal answer to right-wing radio, as well as his own podcast, Love It or Leave It.
He's been a speechwriter for Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and helped create Vote Save America, which has raised tens of millions of dollars for Democratic candidates and voter protection efforts in 2020.
And sadly, he used to do stand-up comedy at open mics.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive. Hey, Hari.
Hey, Kamau. How are you?
You know.
I know. It's a trick question. It's always a trick question. Honestly, you know? We both have depression, so it was a trick question before Trump was president.
Yeah, no. It's getting harder to pretend like things are good. I mean, once again, I'm doing better than 99.9% of the Earth, and yet that last little piece is really hard.
So. As we speak, the Amy Coney Barrett hearings are happening, which is the whole thing is ridiculous. We know she's going to get through. There's no reason why we have to put on a show. It's absolutely absurd. I hate this so much. The debate, I think the VP debate happened last week. That was garbage. There's no reason to have debates anymore. It's ridiculous. Nobody learns anything. They ask Pence a question about Breonna Taylor, and then he turns it into a discussion of the police and quote-unquote riots. It's all theater. It's all bullshit. I hate it. I hate it. I hate it.
Here's where I'm at, because I think a lot of, you know, we're focused on the election, a lot of us, all of us, and the idea of that voting on that day, if Biden-Harris wins, and that's the end of Trump and Trumpism, if he leaves. But, like, a news story broke this week that just sort of proved to me that, like, even if Trump goes and leaves peacefully, like, you know, that we still have to deal with the results of Trumpism, and I think we have to remember that, we have to focus on that. So, in the midst of the torrent of news that has happened, that keeps happening, a little tiny news story emerged of a governor from Michigan named Gretchen Whitmer, who 13 of the citizens of Michigan decided they wanted to kidnap her.
Oh my God, that's right.
It's funny how that would be, like, any other time, that'd be a huge news story, but it's just so much happening and so much trumping that we literally 13 people were hatching a violent plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer. President Trump calls her that woman. And the sheriff of the county where they were hatching this plot, the sheriff, who had been apparently associated with one or some number of the people who were trying to kidnap the governor, had been at, like, a rally with one of them. When they asked him, like, do you feel weird about the fact that you were at this rally? Do you feel weird about the fact you're associated with some of these people who tried to kidnap the governor? He said, well, we have to ask ourselves, is it a kidnapping or were they trying to arrest her?
Oh, my God. It's a kidnapping.
But that's the sheriff. That's the sheriff.
Lawlessness. This is absurd. I mean, and you're right. Things are so fucked up. I forgot that people tried to kidnap the governor of Michigan. That should have led this episode, but yeah. I just got caught up in everything else. Yeah. It's amazing that the Bill of Rights apparently protects the right of white men to have guns and start militias, but somehow I can't bring 10 ounces of toothpaste and grow a beard when I get to the airport. Like, how on earth is that somehow making us safer? And meanwhile, we're allowing these maniacs to do things. I mean, honestly, like, this is terrorism.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons we don't address it is because remember 3 years ago when President Trump got COVID? Remember that?
Oh, right. Forgot about the pandemic. We're in the middle of a pandemic.
Yeah. Well, it's also the thing about, like, just the ways in which him having COVID had played out. Like, he said he's immune to it now, which is not a thing. Did you hear that he had a plan that he talked out of this, that he was going to walk out of the hospital looking weak and fragile. And then as the press started to, like, you know, take pictures or report on it, he was going to turn to all the press and then pull open his shirt. And you would see that he was wearing a Superman T-shirt.
Who gave him that suggestion? Vince McMahon? It was some wrestling thing. Some wrestler said, hey, Don, what you should do is, like, who told you to do that? Ric Flair? Like, what is this? If he did that, is there any way that DC could sue Donald Trump? DC Comics could sue him?
Well, you know, many, many musical artists have said, stop playing that. Stop playing my song. So, right. Like, apparently recently he's been reduced to playing Macho Man by the Village People at his rally. I think it was in Florida. So, I mean, not that that's a bad song, but it's not necessarily a song you would imagine to play at a presidential rally in 2020.
Also, the Village People, does he know? You know, do any of them know? Have you noticed that, like, they always find the most, like, liberal musicians and play their music at their stupid, like, right-wing rallies? And that's because music from conservatives sucks. They don't want to play Toby Keith. Ted Nugent is always available for live appearances. Like, they just don't want to play Kid Rock. He's done everything he can. They're not getting him at all these events. It's not that it's, like, too expensive. Like, they just don't want to play that. You know, it would make sense to me to go ball with the ball, da bang, but, like, that makes more sense to me. But they're like, this sucks. Nobody's going to want to hear this crap.
There is a torrent of news and a torrent of distractions, and I'm not mad at people for being distracted. I get distracted sometimes. But I want to remind us all that one of the most important things we do is to make a voting plan. My friends at the ACLU, aclu.org/vote-now, vote now, vote-now. You can go there and they can and you can figure out how to make a voting plan, because I just got my permanent absentee ballot in the mail, or as the president calls it, voter fraud. I'm very excited to fill it out. I know I'm going to drop it off. And I think with everything going on, you don't get so caught up that voting day comes and you're like, where do I go? What do I do? Or you don't want to be caught up by dropping it in a fake box like they were doing in Southern California, Southern California, in the more red parts, like where Hurry lives. Well, luckily on the podcast today, we have two interviews with people who are actually doing the work, who are actually out here in the world trying to make this world a better place. One from inside the Beltway, or trying to be inside the Beltway, and one who was inside the Beltway, who's now outside the Beltway.
In the second half of the show, we're going to have my buddy John Lovett on, former presidential speechwriter for Barack Obama and the co-host of Pod Save America and the host of Love It or Leave It. One question I did not ask him that I hope to have asked him was whether he still gets confused for John Lovitz, the comedian.
Yeah, but, I'm glad we didn't have time for that. But before we talk to John Lovett, first we're talking to Cori Bush, who is on her way to becoming the first black woman ever to represent Missouri in Congress.
Last week, we talked to Alexander Rojas, the executive director of Justice Democrats, the political action committee that helped elect the squad. Cori Bush was actually the original Justice Democrats candidate, challenging incumbent Democrat Lacey Clay, who has represented Missouri's first House district for 20 years and whose father held the seat for the 30 years before that.
In 2018, she lost to Lacey Clay, but in 2020, she came back and won. So 2020 is not an entire disaster like it always feels. In January, St. Louis is going to have a different kind of representative in Washington, not a career politician, but a working-class black woman who cut her teeth as an organizer in the streets of Ferguson after the murder of Michael Brown, the first member of the House to emerge from this Black Lives Matter movement. Woo, baby!
And if you're wondering, no, she is not related to those Bushes. Let's bring on Cori Bush.
What is your life like right now? What is it? What's going on? I mean, this has got to be a very unique moment for you. You know, being the sort of like, you know, I'll let you take it from there. What is your life like right now?
It's beyond my wildest dreams. It's still really surreal for me because, you know, I didn't know what to expect. No one has had to do this in this particular district for 52 years. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been the same family all of this time. So I had no clue of, you know, what the day after or even the night, you know, would look like that I won. And so all of a sudden, you know, I'm getting calls from people that, you know, I see on TV, you know, I'm getting, you know, invited into spaces and given information that I'm, you know, and then being an activist, some of it is just like, really? Like, I get access to this information, you know, because it's like, if they give it to anybody, they're not giving it to the activists, you know. It's like, here, Cori, here's your, and I'm, you know, so it's just like a whole different world. You know, it's been amazing. I've been able to go to D.C. and just walk around the Capitol and meet people, talk to Congress members quite a bit. Met with the Congressional Black Caucus. I've met with the squad. The squad is so helpful. And, you know, we talk basically daily at some point, some kind of the way we're all like in communication or just some kind of a way we're working together, even if it's on social media, you know, it's been phenomenal. And, you know, the youth and the children that know who I am and that walk up to me and hug me. And, you know, it's just a totally different life. And I'll say this, and people that didn't want to talk to me before I won.
Suddenly they found your number.
Yeah, you know, they some of them worked hard to get it. But it's okay. You know what? I'm working for them too. You know, we gotta, you know, I won't hold it against anyone. We're going to start from here and we're going to build. Now let's see what we can do together.
You know, one of the things I think is I'm trying to do in my work is explain to the most of America that black people are not a monolith, that we don't all think mm-hmm. the same way on the same issues all mm-hmm. the time. But you did it in a real big way by running against an incumbent black candidate. And you mentioned the Congressional Black Caucus. I assume things are cool there now because you're running against a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. Can you talk about that? And somebody who had been a long-term legacy candidate in where you live.
It was tough because not only had his father held the seat for 32 years, and then he you know, has been in the seat now for 20, but with him, his father was one of the co-founders of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Wow.
You know, so that was, you know, so right. So that was a lot. And then just being his father was well respected in the community, just being an activist himself. But to me, I felt like honoring the work that his father did and honoring that legacy isn't trying to keep a name in the seat or putting a name on a building. Like, that's not honoring the legacy to me. Honoring the legacy to me would be picking up that torch and following in that work and continuing to have your feet on the ground and doing that same type of work until we get to the goal, you know? And because we weren't doing that, it was time for new leadership. And it's okay, you know, the leadership that he, you know, his way of leading is different than my way of leading. But I will say this, some of the way that I feel now may not necessarily, like, I didn't feel all of this or think this way years ago before Michael Brown was murdered or even before I went through some of my own hardships. So it was because I went through certain experiences that I ended up here and I have the values that I have right now. So I can't fault him because he had a different upbringing. He was brought up by a congressperson and all of that. So we have a very different upbringing. And as far as the Congressional Black Caucus, my thing to them was, I honor the work that they've done, and they have been, you know, I believe more like a safe space for other Congress members that look like me, you know, and that space is needed, especially in Congress. So we respect that. But my concern was, I don't think that we should publicly endorse people unless we know that they are doing the work in their communities that their communities need. And I don't care who you are. I don't care if we're friends or not. I can be your friend and just not be outspoken for you while you're running for office. But on the other side of that, saying, hey, come on, boo, like, get, you know, you need to do better in this community. Like, you need to do this or do that. If you want my endorsement, I need to see something different out of you, because our job, we are holding a space to make sure that we are helping change America and make America, you know, make America who America says it is, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for every person here. And so what is your district looking like right now? So that's all I was saying. So that's why I ran. So yeah, it was difficult because people were like, oh, why are you running against, you know, you're a traitor. You running, you're a black woman running against a black man. And I'm like, no, the traitor is me not standing up for the people in my community that have the least. I'm one of those people that had some, that at times in my life had the least, and I felt like nobody was speaking for me. And so that is the place where I start now. When I, anything that I'm doing, any policy, you know, whatever I'm working toward, I'm looking at the person in the community that has the least. And then that's how we build.
You know, you said you were sort of inspired to get into political, into politics coming out of the uprising in Ferguson. There's a lot of attention on Ferguson. That attention has shifted and gone away. What do you think people still don't understand about Ferguson, or don't understand about the uprising to this day?
First of all, there was no, you know, like, we didn't know that that was going to happen to Michael Brown Jr. before it happened. So we didn't know to be ready. We didn't know to be in place. We didn't, like, there was no instruction manual that said, if this ever happens in your community, if you are a chef, this is what you do. If you want to protest, if you want to speak out, this, if you're a this, this is what you do. If you're a preacher, you do this. Like, none of that. If you're under the age of this, this is what you do. Like, none of that happened. And so we showed up because an 18-year-old baby was murdered in our community and was murdered by a police officer, and we're watching his body on social media laying on the ground in the hot St. Louis sun, 100 degrees outside for 4 hours. You know, it ended up being 4.5 hours. So that's why we showed up, and we wanted to know what happened. And the reports that we were getting from people who were witnesses and then what the police was putting out was two different things. We need people to know that we didn't know each other the day before. You know, now we're a family 6 years later, but we didn't know each other the day before. We just went out because we wanted to see justice, and we didn't understand what was happening, because if we sat back and kept quiet with that, it could happen to somebody else the next day, you know? And so we spoke up. The other thing is we did not receive money. Those Ferguson activists out there on the ground, some of us call ourselves Ferguson Frontline because we were the ones that was out there like 400 days strong. We didn't get money. Like, money was going into all of these places, to these organizations and all of that. Money did not come to us. We didn't take a dollar. Nobody gave us a dollar. You know, we were out there on the ground. Let me tell you, we would get a sandwich, a sub sandwich, and cut it up into pieces to make sure everybody ate. I missed bills because I'm helping pay stuff for people. I was running behind on my own personal bills. We would go to the store and buy a box of feminine products and pass them out. Like, we would have people that would go and use their own money and buy and make big buckets of chili so that we could eat. Like, that's, we were in a place of, you know, we didn't get money. And and let me say, today, so many of those same people are still financially in, you know, really difficult places, still struggling. But not only are they struggling, they're struggling with PTSD now. They're struggling with the effects of tear gas from being tear gassed so much, and now it's affected their eyes or their lungs. And they don't have health insurance. So we're talking about some real stuff that people are really living through. So that's what people don't know. You know, people don't celebrate the people that was out there giving their lives. We lost homes, we lost jobs, we lost friends and family. You know, people, you know, we need people to know that this thing was real for us. It wasn't about becoming a name and becoming a famous activist. No, it was about justice for Michael Brown.
You've had such an amazing life so far in terms of the number of different things you've done, the roles you've played as a nurse, as a pastor, as an organizer, and now as, God willing, a congresswoman. Do you see a link between all the different roles you've played in terms of, like, a through line?
It's serving leadership.
is just a love of humanity. That's the core of it. Just loving people because we breathe, you know, because we're human. Because somebody loved me enough, you know, when I felt I was unlovable. You know, I felt I was unlovable because I went through my own situation where I was, you know, I was that kid. I was that A student. I was, you know, doing well. And I had worked it out with my parents. Like, okay, like every night at dinner, my dad would always say, you're going to, this was his speech at dinner. You're going to go to a great college. You're going to go to Howard University. You're going to be the U.S. Attorney General, you know, you're going to have a family, you know, like he would tell me those things all the time, every day. And I was like, I don't even know what a U.S. Attorney General is, but okay, but I want to go to Howard. I remember as a kid, that's what I would say to him. But, and so I had the grades. I was the A student, even an A in conduct. Like I was that kid. And then I went through a situation when I was 14 where an administrator at the school that I was about to enter, I went from an all black school to an all white school. And basically I went in as the number one student and I was treated terribly. It was the first time that I experienced discrimination in that way. It was really, really bad. And it affected me to the point to where I decided I no longer wanted people to know that I was smart. I transferred out into another place. But from that moment on, I couldn't be smart. I felt like if people saw that I was intelligent, they would hurt me. And so I ended up in drugs. I ended up in alcohol. I ended up doing some with a whole different life, ended up not getting a scholarship like I had planned all of those years. I didn't get a scholarship to go with a full ride to go to the school of my choice. I ended up becoming a low wage worker. And I did that for several years. I ended up unhoused, living out of a car with two kids, two babies, actually, mixing formula in the bathroom. I went through, ended up a survivor of domestic violence. I almost lost my life. The person left me for dead. You know, he thought I was dead on the ground. I went through sexual assault. I went through so many things. But somebody reached out to help me. And I'll never forget that somebody reached out to help me in the middle of all of my mess. And I remember that one of those days I was cut up. I remember I was at work and I was just a mess, but the person reached out and helped me, you know, and from that moment on, my life started to change. And so I want to be able to be that for other people. I don't want anyone to walk into any of the things that I've had to go through in my life. So if I can do anything to fix that and stop that, that's why I speak up. That's why I do what I do. Because I know the power of people and the power of love.
Oh my God, I can't wait for you to get into office. I'm like so excited just hearing you talk. I'm like, I'm so happy for you and your constituents right now. Like, I can't wait for this election. Wow.
I mean, yeah, it's incredible. I feel like I want to call you Congresswoman right now, but I know we have to wait until all the... Well, you'll be my congresswoman forever, no matter what happens. But we know we have good feelings about it. When you tell your biography like that, it becomes clear to me that, like, that's not what this country has said the biography of somebody who's a congressperson should have. Like, a lot of that's, and, you know, I certainly believe you that the system played a huge role in making all that stuff happen. And as far and you saying the thing about transferring schools and going from being smart to being told you're not is the same thing happened to my mom, who's 83 years old. So to me, it's like that's still happening. It's still occurring. So I think that's important to note that that's not the first time that happened. Hopefully, and sadly, not the last. But what does it say to you that the biography you had at some point would have been disqualifying to be a congressperson, and now it is not?
Yeah, that is disturbing, you know, but it's what we know. We know that more than we know that there is another way. You know, people expect, you know, even when I said, hey, I'm going to run for U.S. Congress, people were like, oh, but you're not an attorney. You can't do that. You know, oh, well, where did you graduate? Like, where did you graduate from school from? Or what do you, you know, who are your parents? You know, so it was like you either had to have, or what is your, how many elected offices have you held? You know, so you either had to come up through those ranks or you had to be of a particular family name, even though I am of a family name called Bush. No, that's a whole other thing. No, but, you know, not that Bush family. But
different branches of the family tree.
You know, my ancestors came over. They didn't have a last name called Bush. Yes. They didn't have it. So but we won't even go down that. This was a name that was tacked on to us at some point in time. The idea that you have to have one of those pieces in order to fit, you know, and not only that. And then I don't look the part. You know, people would say to me like, you know, your braids are unprofessional. So if you want to, you know, if you want to get into some of these tables, if you want to get to the seat at these tables, or if you want to get into these rooms, you need to make your appearance, you know, more professional, you know, because me, I would get off work sometimes and head to a meeting. If it wasn't a speaking engagement, I was coming in my scrubs sometimes, you know, I'm straight off work, you know, so I'm in scrubs, or I'm straight off the street and protesting. So I'm coming in a t-shirt with a bandana and some boots on, you know, because look, I got to be ready. But people like, oh, she's so unprofessional. Let me tell you, I'm a church girl. I grew up in the church. I know how to put on I know how to do it up. I know how to look like, you know, I know how to dress. You know, that's not the issue. It's just being ready and, you know, and then representing the people in your community. So I don't care what people say now. You can think what you want to think about, you know, me and other regular everyday people, but we need more people like us in those seats, because the people that are in a lot of those seats, not all, but a lot of those seats are so disconnected from the communities that they serve that they don't even understand how to reach the people. And then the people don't even understand what's available. Like, we don't even know we could have more in our districts because it's been missing from us for so long. And our last point on this, when I was running, the incumbent put out some really terrible ads, of course. And one of the ads, so one ad talked about my history. You know, I talked about being low wage. I talked about I had a lot of financial struggles. I've never been quiet about that, you know, because being poor is expensive. And so my credit was, you know, really jacked up. And he talked about that. And he talked about my evictions. You know, he talked about those things as a disqualifier, you know, for me going into the seat at a time when millions of people have lost jobs. And people have lost homes and all of that at a time. So that's a disqualifier, he felt. He was that disconnected. He was disconnected to say that my love and my respect for the Palestinian community and Muslims across our country was a disqualifier, because I believe in loving all of humanity, regardless of where you come from and what you look like and who you love. And he felt that was a disqualifier. That's the disconnect. So we need people like us that come to have lived experience in these seats.
I know that in the last election, AOC endorsed you, was very excited to endorse you. This election, she did not formally endorse you. Why do you think that is, and how do you respond to that?
So, you know, Alex and I met 2017 at a Justice Democrats Brand New Congress, I believe, summit. And when she was trying to make her decision to run or not, I was already had already made my decision, but she was still deciding. And I remember sitting at the table across from her, and she was just talking. And I was like, look, this is why you need to run. What just came out of your mouth? Like, I believe you are fierce and we need you to run. And she ended up making that decision to run. And from that moment on, we became friends and we stayed in contact. You know, we would call each other, text, you know, we were on chats together. And then we made the plan for me to the week before her race, I was supposed to go to New York and help her around GOTV. And then she would in turn do the same thing for me for GOTV for my race. I ended up being hit by a car. And so I couldn't walk. So I wasn't able to go to New York. It happened a few weeks before her race. So I wasn't able to go to New York. But she came. She still, even though she won and everything was going on, she still took the time to come to St. Louis to help stump for me. And when she came, that was actually when I first started walking again. So there are pictures of her helping me walk, because I was still having trouble walking, difficulty walking. So the next time when it was time for me to run again, she was already on a committee with working with the incumbent for my district. I understood that this is somebody she has to work next to. We all have our own decisions to make, you know, and that was the decision that she chose, was to just stay out of it. And that's okay. That was her decision. I can't say I'm not there. So I can't say, you know, what that looks like, but I do understand that she had to make a decision. What she did not do, though, was come out against me, because this is the person that she's sitting closely with and working with every day. And so now we have her, you know, now we are endorsed by her, and she and I talk.
right. I'm just amazed, because during what you were saying, you casually slipped in that you were hit by a car. You are unsinkable. You are the unsinkable Cori Bush. I'm hearing this and I'm like, my God, like, I feel like what you were saying before, there are so many people in your constituency who can relate to you on such a deep level and who have all suffered different types of pain. And you're in this race right now uninsured. That and which shocked me because I'm like, but you're running for Congress. I'm like, but that makes you so much more relatable to everyone right now.
When I first announced I was still working as a nurse, I was the director of a community-based health clinic. And it was just, it got to the point to where it was like, I just, there had to be a decision made, either run for the seat or continue to work full time. And so I had to, I worked my last two races, I worked full time. This time I said, I have to do something different so that I can win this race. And so I decided to, I knew that it would mean that I would have health insurance because I didn't, I wouldn't have an income, you know? And so, but I took the plunge and it was like every month, figure out how you're going to pay your bills while you're running for office. You know, it literally, that's what it was. Figure out how you're going to pay your bills every single month. And then when it was time, when I was able to take a, legally able to take a salary, that's what I did, was I was able to take a salary from the campaign so I could continue working. But I didn't want to take a salary and have the campaign pay my health insurance because I didn't want to take that much money from the campaign. I just didn't, you know, it was hard enough taking the salary, but I needed to at least be able to pay my rent. So, but when my COVID-19 situation happened, when that illness hit me March 24th this year, that I hadn't, I didn't expect. So that thing knocked me off my feet. I ended up hospitalized twice. Wow. And so now I have those and I'm still uninsured. So now I have those bills on top of everything else. And right now I still don't, I don't have a salary. We're back to the place of not having a salary, you know, so we're doing, I'm doing what I can, but I can't pay medical bills right now, you know, just like so many people across the country and in the world.
It's just a, I mean,
unsinkable.
Yeah, unsinkable. I think that's the key here. I think that hearing your struggle, hearing what you're literally going through as you're running for office, that in a place where many candidates are eating high off the hog and enjoying themselves, and you're out here still doing the work and still struggling like most people who are in this country right now, is just amazing. So yeah. I know you've looked forward to this. Let's you win. You are officially a congresswoman. What are your priorities for your community? What do you see doing once you get in there? Causing some of that good trouble, I imagine.
Good trouble, yes. So first thing straight out the gate, hopefully we will have something, some real COVID-19 relief. So first it will start there. $2,000 a month, universal basic income that would be retroactive back to March for every person, you know, as well as a real moratorium on evictions and, you know, canceling shutoffs. Also, the money to make sure that our homeowners that that they don't lose their properties because their renters aren't paying rent. So Ilhan Omar has a very good plan for that. So supporting her plan, the $2,000 plan is the one that Rashida Tlaib has proposed. So supporting that plan. Also putting money into education. We have so many students that don't have the equipment that they need at home, or there are two children or three children, you know, or whatever. They all need a laptop or something to work off of so that they can do their learning, whether it's all fully online or hybrid learning, making sure money for tutors, because some of our children are not doing as well as they would have if they were able to go to be in class. And then pushing Medicare for all, then that way we don't have to worry about who has health care and who doesn't. Health care is a human right in my eyes, and it should be for everyone. We just saw why health care should not be connected to job status. So also a $15 federal minimum wage, $15 is not going to make anyone rich. It's not going to make the have not, the haves are like so worried that the have nots become the haves because we moved to a $15 an hour minimum wage. You know, no, it's just making sure that we are not desolate in the country where we live and where we're working. And you know, I'm defunding the police. Woo. I'm about defunding the police, and I don't shy away from saying that. People may not like that language, but we have to defund the police because the same idea where we feel like by throwing money at police that is going to help police be better. If that was the case, then George Floyd would still be alive right now, because after Philando Castile was murdered, the governor in Minnesota gave $12 million for training. You know, so if he gave $12 million for training after Philando Castile was murdered, well, was the training, was, did we see the, that, the effects of that training when George Floyd was murdered? Was that the training to put your knee on someone's neck? So throwing money at it isn't the issue. We need to start taking the money back from, you know, that's being used for MRAPs and rubber bullets and bear mace and all of that. We need to take that money back and put that money into job training, job trainings and other community programs, you know, helping with people that are in substance use situations, domestic violence situations. Make mental health professionals, have them be the ones that are doing the mental health work on the street, not cops. That's not their jobs. And making sure that a cop goes to, you know, gets more, has more training than 28 weeks or 16 weeks and all of that. It's foolishness. A healthcare, somebody that's learning how to do hair, that's becoming a hairstylist, has to go to training, go to school longer than that. So those are a few of them.
So not much. You don't have much on your agenda. Just figure out where the bathrooms are.
Right.
Find some place to eat lunch every day. Rescue democracy. That's all that's on your... on your agenda. Save the country from the clutches of the current administration. That's it. Okay.
Exactly.
Cori Bush is a Democratic nominee to represent Missouri's 1st District, which includes St. Louis and nearby communities in the House of Representatives.
Knock Down the House, the documentary that tells the story of Cori Bush's first run for Congress, as well as those of three other first-time candidates, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is still on Netflix and is still inspiring.
Coming up, speechwriter, comedian, and podcaster John Lovett, founder of Crooked Media and co-host of Pod Safe America. As a speechwriter, our next guest, John Lovett, was close to the heart of power in Washington, D.C. He worked for Hillary Clinton when she was a senator and in her first run for the presidency in 2008. And then he became a speechwriter for President Barack Obama.
But since Donald Trump became president, John has become part of an effort outside Washington that's probably had a lot more political impact, joining fellow former Obama staffers Jon Favreau, Dan Pfeiffer, and Tommy Vietor in founding the liberal media company Crooked Media and its first podcast, Pod Save America.
They've used their podcast to feature the voices and perspectives of the Democratic Party and to raise tens of millions of dollars for its candidates and get out the vote efforts through its Vote Save America platform.
And they've also launched John's own live panel podcast, Love It or Leave It. Also, he's engaged to Ronan Farrow. Let's talk to John Lovett. John, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
No, this is great. You and I have actually have a lot in common that we haven't discussed.
Okay.
We both went to small liberal arts schools in New England. You went to Williams. I went to Bowdoin College. We both graduated in 2004, right?
Yeah.
We both grew up in New York. You grew up in Long Island. But we both grew up in New York. You grew up in Long Island. And
I know I did. Like, I'm not defensive about, like, I know that I didn't.
Do you own up, like, when people say, hey, where did you grow up? Do you say New York or do you say Long Island?
I would say that I, it is a mix, but it is not a mix born of defensiveness. If someone's asking me where I grew up, I usually want to not have a conversation about it. So it's like, I'm not proudly from Long Island, you know, LIE, you know, raised, exit
right.
43. Like, I'm not going to be bashful about it, but I'm not.
Big up Long Island Ducks, quack, quack.
Go Islanders, you know, but I'm not going to make a big stink about it.
I'm making a stink about it because I'm projecting onto you because I know too many people who say they're from New York and then they're like, we're in New York, the Hamptons, Suffolk County.
You're in San Diego, Hurry. I don't even think this is fair.
Hey, we don't need to keep talking about that. I'm here because I had a child and we had to be here for the child. That's why we're
That's
here.
What everybody who moves to Long Island says.
The final thing that I know that we have in common that I just realized yesterday is that I interned for then Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton in the summer of 2003, and you were hired to assist Sarah Hurwitz as her speechwriter.
Yes, I worked for, well, I was in the Senate office, and then I joined Sarah on the campaign in 2008. I also interned for Hillary Clinton, maybe at around the same time.
When I was in the office, there were always whispers about Anthony Weiner, like hitting on Huma and really liking Huma and stopping by to just say hello to Huma. And it was kind of like, what is he doing? Like, this isn't going to happen. When you were there, was that still happening?
When did they start dating and getting married? I assume so. I mean, I was there 2005 to like to early 2009, right when President Obama was inaugurated. I don't remember.
What we're
like,
learning,
he wasn't a big part of my job. Anthony Weiner relationship is not a big part of the speech writing role.
I mean, to be fair, I was like sorting out mail, so it was like the perfect place for gossip. Like there was constant whispers and stuff. And which, by the way, I was in the office shortly after the anthrax scares, so I very much sympathize with the Secret Service right now. It's not a good position to be in.
They're like, we got the perfect job for you.
Right.
We're so appreciative of all your hard work. We got the perfect job for you. It's actually not in the main office. It's in an annex.
Right.
And you just got to open this mail. Just open this mail. Tell us what's in there. That's it. It's pretty easy. It's kind of fun.
Right.
It's a mystery.
Circumstances.
I guess I have a question. Hari, do you mind if I ask a question?
Oh, yeah. If you want to do serious political interviewing, yeah, we can.
It's not even that. If you look at Barack likes being on stage. You know, like he enjoys that spotlight. And I think inside him somewhere is like, I'm kind of competing against the greatest black orators of all time. Like, if you know, I'm sort of like, I'm competing against Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, you know, like whoever it is. It feels like he's aware of like, I'm trying to hit that bar, you know, Jay-Z. You know? And that yeah, Hillary, I mean, like, I just always get,
yeah.
Yeah. And not to make it too much about Hillary, but that it was just the fact that, like, I felt like I don't know that she likes being up there in the same way. Like, I think she's like, I've done the work. Like, you know, this is not where I get the most buzz, you know?
Yeah, I think two things. I think, first of all, I think that's right. I remember when I was in the Senate office, there was a person on our policy team that wanted to be working on the campaign. And she said something to that person along the lines of like, oh, I don't want you in that mess. Like, I want you here working on policy. I want you here doing this good work. And I think there was a part of her that always thought, this is the stuff you have to do, the position, the way you have to be to get to the good stuff, which is governing, the part she really cared about. And, you know, I think that was something she felt to a fault, like, you know, she viewed that you had to campaign one way in order to kind of get to the job you were really interested in doing. I also think, though, it's like nobody compares well to Barack Obama. So in a lot of ways, we're paying for Barack Obama's incredible political talent, his once-in-a-generational political talent. It turned out that, you know, in many ways, we had hoped that he represented some new cosmopolitan majority, right, that was coming, right? And he actually does. But he kind of jumped a few steps because his talent and skills allowed us to overlook the ways in which there was this revanchist right, that we were losing state legislative seats, that there was this other part of America that was not quite ready to let go of the reins.
I sort of felt like after Obama won, and it's like after his 8 years, that I sort of thought that knowing that he had sort of, like you said, jumped a few spots, that the Democratic leadership would be like, okay, we need to find people who are ready to jump a few spots. You know what I mean? That, like, in the same way that, like I always said, the NBA in the 80s just went to Africa and looked for tall dudes. Like, they just were like, you know, like, we clearly need to find other tall dudes. Let's go look for other places where we did not look for them. And that's how there's a whole influx of talent from parts of Africa, because the NBA was like, we can't keep looking on basketball courts in America. And I felt like with the Democratic leadership, I thought there would be a sense of like, for the next presidential candidate, we will go out to find those people who are ready to jump the next spots. And it seemed like it didn't really happen that way.
There has been, in the Trump years, a search for new talent, like a generational talent, right? Like AOC, we see Jamal Bowman, we see all kinds of people, Katie Porter, like just tons of incredibly, the squad, you see incredibly talented, progressive people running for office. They don't sound like traditional politicians. They don't run like traditional politicians. They're building a new kind of base of support. But then in the primary, you know, you have Bernie, you have Elizabeth Warren, you have a bunch of other people competing for the center right lane. And the primary was a whole bunch of people in the midst of an emergency, in the midst of experiencing trauma, trying to figure out how to get out of it. You know, I talked to a therapist on Love It or Leave It about this, that like usually when your house is on fire, you don't sit down for a therapy session about how to process the fact that your house is on fire. You get out. You get out, you make sure everybody's safe, and then you begin the process of dealing with the trauma you experience. But we are mid-trauma. We are in the middle of it. And so there was a competing, there were these two sort of, I think, very, like, there were these competing ideas. One was just a need for safety, just a genuine a need to get to safety, whatever that means for people. And then there was a sense that, wait a second, we need to attack the underlying conditions that allowed someone like Trump to become president in the first place. We need to get back to normal and we need to change what's normal. And those two things were really in tension. They were in tension in terms of the policy fight, but they were also in tension, I think, among voters who might have preferred Elizabeth Warren, but ultimately were convinced that it was too risky, right? Convinced that misogyny run too deep, that this wasn't the election to take that shot, you know? So it's so hard to me to understand this from inside of it. And I wonder how we'll feel about the primary and what happened once we're sort of on, ideally, you know, on the outside of this period, looking back in. Like, it seems one thing I keep trying to remember, keep trying to remind myself is we do not know what the legacy of Trump plus economic crisis plus pandemic will be. We just don't know. We don't know how it will reshape our culture. We don't know how it will reshape our politics. We are still inside of it.
John, I think your point is very well put about, like, you know, this is a fire, so we have to get to safety. You know, just, you know, I've been calling Joe Biden a tourniquet. I mean, that's what he is. He's just stop the bleeding. Let's actually, you know, get to work once we get there. But I feel like the Democratic Party always treats it like a fire. This is an inferno. This is an absolute inferno. But it's been election after election after election of hearing who is the most electable, who is the safest bet to get in. You know, Barack Obama, his ascendance feels like it was in spite of the Democratic Party. It wasn't because of the Democratic Party. And all the growth we've seen, whether it was AOC or Jamal Bowman or Cori Bush, you know, that's happening because of groups like Justice Democrats and organizations that are seen as outsider organizations. So, you know, I totally hear you with this election being, you know, we're in the middle of an inferno, please just get us safety. But is that also a bit of the dysfunction of the Democratic Party always treating every single election like a fire, especially when the incumbent's a Republican, as opposed to looking forward?
Yeah, I mean, yes.
Right.
Yeah. Like, what is the Democratic Party? The Democratic Party, there's no, like to your point, right? Like, most in 2008, a lot of people sat back or went with Hillary Clinton until it looked like Barack Obama was moving ahead. And then all of a sudden, everybody sort of was like, oh no, I'm on the wrong train. I got to switch trains, right? Like, right. The party didn't follow, the members of the party didn't follow the leaders of the party. The leaders followed the members of the party. Even in this primary, you cannot, I think, argue that for the most of the time the primary was unfolding, that this was a party leadership that was pushing towards Joe Biden. This was, I mean, it just didn't happen. Mm-hmm. It happened at the very, very end. At the very, right. very end. But and honestly, it happened. You know, Joe Biden became the nominee despite that lack of enthusiasm from the elite of the party. They just weren't behind him. They weren't behind anybody. They were a little bit torn. They weren't sure what to do. They were like everybody else, right? There was just no clear person. There just wasn't. To me, what I see is, like, I want to be in a place where Democrats get behind an unabashed progressive who believes that those positions are not just the right thing to do, but the way to win, that there's a consensus around doing that, right? That we have already shifted to the left, but I know what you're looking for. I know what you're hoping for. And like, I want to get there too. And I think, to me, the question I'm going to start asking after this election is, all right, we're going to fight the next 3 weeks on the ACA, on economic stimulus, on ordinary politics and policy, when what we're in is a knockdown, drag out fight to save democracy. What is it that has made progressivism such a hard sell that this thing is going to be close? What do we have to do to make Democrats more appealing to millions and millions of people who have been suckered into a kind of right-wing revanchist politics. There's like a lot of really hard work to do, I think, after this election. But, you know, that's a long-winded, rambling series of thoughts, but that's where I'm at.
I think that's where we're all at. I think
yeah, I think it's fair.
I guess, I mean, when you say the things like what is it going to take to get the country behind a progressive, isn't a lot of the things that keep the country from getting behind the progressive the ways in which electoral politics in this country are structured that put the thumb on the scale for the right?
There is a thumb on the scales for the right wing. Of course there is. But, you know, two things about that. One, we've seen a bunch of very red states expand Medicaid, raise the minimum wage, support unions. So there is an appetite for progressive politics. You know, somebody made this point that the best kind of Democrat we could run in a red state is just the Democratic policy platform without a human Democrat at the top. that there's something, but there is, but like that delta, right? That space between policy, what people think of as what they want out of government, and Democratic politics, like what explains that gap, right? Like, we have a real shot right now in the Senate races in Iowa, in Kansas. But I have no doubt that on the issues, we'd be polling better than those candidates. And so, like, yeah, I agree, like, on the Electoral College, like, we have this incredible disadvantage. But what I sort of come back to is we should tackle those anti-democratic institutions however we can, whether they're the courts or vote suppression, gerrymandering, what have you. But I also don't want us to ever accept that, oh yeah, those states, like, we can't win there. Those aren't places where Democrats can win. They're in places where progressives can win. I just don't believe that. Like, I don't think politics is that permanent. Like, things shift. They shift very, very quickly.
John, you've used the word revanchist twice now. What does that word mean?
It's make America great again. It's we want to go back to the past. We want to go back to a white,
that's perfect,
idealized history.
Revanchist. I like it. Revanchist.
I don't know. Why am I using that? I must have seen it. I must have seen it on. I saw it on some toilet paper. You know.
We can't not talk about the Supreme Court.
Sure.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying. The Supreme Court. I'm just gonna say. Like, I turned on the hearings this morning for like. Like, I turned it on. Let me watch a little bit. And after about a minute, I was like, nope, can't do it. Can't do it.
Can't do it.
Amy Coney Barrett, for or against?
No, I'm a no. I'm a no in committee. I'll see how I feel on the floor. What is the purpose of these hearings, right? You know, they're at the culmination of a 40-year project to, end Roe versus Wade. To ensconce an anti-labor, pro-corporate majority on the court for a generation. It is a project that they have been working on for 40 years. And we're all going to pretend for this 1 week period that nobody knows what she thinks. Like, she wrote it down. She's written it down many times. Right? She wrote a very long, well-written piece about originalism, and when she talks about her originalism, it is a genuinely held belief. It is what she will do when she is on the court. It demands the overthrow of a host of environmental laws, healthcare laws. It's not just the Affordable Care Act. You know, if she had her druthers, I don't know that if she was put in a position of having to uphold the Social Security Administration, she'd want to do that. Now, we don't know what she'll actually do on those sort of on those things, right? Because these originalists have a funny way of protecting their power by not showing you what its radicalism would actually mean in practice. They have they mete it out, right? It's dangerous to take the full dose, so they put it in your food a little bit at a time. But, you know, we know what you do. So these hearings are a bit of a farce, and I'm glad the Democrats are using it to just hammer on the Affordable Care Act and some of these issues to try to get some political value out of this farce. But other than that, you know, it's a show.
If she's an originalist, you mean like she's like Scalia, like she interprets the Constitution the way it was interpreted by the founders. Here's the thing. She's a woman, so if she really believed that, she wouldn't be talking right now. Like, how does that work?
the silliness to me of originalism is, if you really, if the job was really just to know what the founders intended in the words, right? If you, if the goal was just to understand the literal meaning of the Constitution at the time, you don't need lawyers. You would need historians.
Right.
Right. But we need lawyers because I don't know what an original, like, you know, when the FTC auctions off radio waves, like, I, like, what would James Madison do? Like, stop pretending that what you're not doing isn't interpretation, yeah, isn't magical thinking. Like, we're all interpreting this document. You are not the only group of people not interpreting this document. It's farce. It's not real. It's a game.
Is there any way that Barrett doesn't get confirmed? Are there four Republicans who would say no at this point?
Doesn't seem like it, you know. It does. It seems here's, this is again, like, we are on the, like, knife's edge at the end of Democratic politics working at all. So that's why we have to win. If what we're relying on is the courage of individual Republicans, that tells you that the system is broken. Because if doing the right thing requires Herculean courage according to our system, that's stupid. That's stupid. We should. I'm like, waiting for Republican heroes is a terrible way to live, and I would like to stop doing that. Like, I, you know what? John McCain put his thumb down, and it was honestly, it was one of the most inspiring things I'd ever seen on C-SPAN. It really was, but it never should have come to that. Never, yes, should have come to that.
Although you did say the most, one of the most inspiring things I've ever seen on C-SPAN, which really does limit its level of inspiration.
You're damn right I limited it.
A lot of the talk about how to get the Supreme Court back is through adding seats to the Supreme Court. The hope that when Biden wins, I'm saying win, I don't know why I'm saying, but if Biden wins, that they add seats to the Supreme Court. Biden has been very elusive. I think he almost said we don't deserve to know the answer. Then I think he caught himself. Where do you stand on adding seats to the Supreme Court, or AKA court packing, which makes it sound dirtier?
I think two things. One, it tells you a lot about so much of the news media. When the right says that there's a liberal bias in mainstream news, like, they're not wrong, but it plays both ways, because in so many ways, Joe Biden is the natural protagonist and Donald Trump is the natural antagonist in our news. But that also means that they hold him to an incredibly high standard because he's supposed to be the protagonist.
Yes.
And so we are directing these questions about a hypothetical court packing, court rebalancing, as we say.
Oh, nice.
Court reforming, court improving, court renovating. When Mike Pence in the debate says he refuses to answer what they would do if Roe v. Wade is overturned, something they're actively trying to do right now, right? That tells you something. Like, that to me, right, that's a real impact on the lives of millions and millions of people, right? Not a procedural event, not a norm, like, real people's lives on the line. And we don't get an answer. So that's what I think about the hypothetical. To me, if we're talking about this in terms of what is the right number of seats on the Supreme Court and what is the goal of the Supreme Court in our system, right? Like, that's a process argument. To me, based on if we're going to have a 6-3 Supreme Court, we're going to really have to choose, right? Do we want something akin to a Green New Deal to survive judicial review? Do we want to expand healthcare? Do you want that to survive judicial? Do you want environmental regulations, labor rules, corporate reform? Do you want any of the big items that basically a consensus in Democratic politics is forming around, God willing, we're able to win the House and keep the House and win the Senate? Do we want those things overturned? Do we think we have time for that shit? Do we have time to pass something like a Green New Deal, then watch it get killed, then try to pass it again? I don't think so. I don't think we have time to do that. I think we're in a real emergency. So for me, like, it's similar, same thing with the filibuster. I don't know why we're talking about it in abstract. We're going to have to choose as a country. Like, do we want to solve these problems, or do we want to allow a right-wing court to survive based on the random death timings of various old jurists to prevent us from doing those things?
My fear is, if we, let's say, we add three more justices to the court, doesn't that just mean when the Republicans, if it swings back, they'll add three more justices, and this just continues forever?
Man, so, you live in San Diego now.
That's not ideal.
Is that what you were talking about on the 17th green?
Just enjoy your plain oatmeal, man.
Look, Hari. Look, I understand we're kind of like centrist, like you were coming from on this. Like,
that
I get
is bullshit.
Fear.
This is no, I've never been accused.
Look, Kamala. Look, we can just. I get it. I get your fear. I get your reticence. Like that's it's. I get it. I get the political pragmatism you've always brought to these kinds of conversations.
Yes,
totally
yes, yes.
It.
Thank you.
But, how dare you?
So I think like here's the deeper worry that I have where I agree. It's that at some point, like to add seats to the Supreme Court is just to fundamentally accept without reservation that this is a purely political arm of the government. It is a shitty third Congress, a shitty second Congress, right? That's what it is. It's like a shitty other branch of Congress. Like that's sort of kind of what we'd be accepting. We're nostalgic for something that never existed, which is a judicial system that is apolitical, nonpartisan in some fundamental way. I don't know how we get back to that. Like, I don't know how we get back to that. Sometimes I think really what we're saying is we liked it when Republicans appointed liberals too. Like, we liked it when Stevens got through. We liked it when Souter got through. Like, we liked that. And they didn't like that. They hated that. Republicans hated that. But barring that, like, what are our options here? A permanent right-wing majority on the court or a system where if you ever get the White House, the Senate, and the House, you can change the makeup of the Supreme Court, which is better. I don't know, but I kind of want to take a chance on one where we have a progressive Supreme Court. And I think to the point that the conversation we were having earlier, like we bet on democracy. We make DC a state. We end the filibuster. We show people what progressive government can actually do when we have the power of democracy behind us, when we have control and we have the power and we use it. We fight gerrymandering. We make voting easier. We take all these steps to make voting more powerful than vote suppression and then bet on America, bet on people to prevent a Republican takeover to undo the change of Supreme Court. They won't want to put the government in the hands of Republicans in the House, the Senate, and the presidency because they won't want, because it's not what they agree with. It's not what they believe in.
Boom. Take that, old man.
Stop it. This is bullshit. I am not a centrist. Can we trust the polls, John? Is that
no.
even?
No.
Right?
Okay. No.
All right.
Fuck
I'll
that.
Answer that
no.
for you, John.
No.
No.
Absolutely not. Go to sleep every night, warm in your bed, like the polls are fucking dead on accurate. Then get up in the morning and live as if the polls are completely wrong and we're down by 1 point. The other thing is, we don't just need to win. We need to run up the fucking score.
Yeah.
Because we know that some of those early results are going to come in from Election Day showing Donald Trump with a lead in certain states. We need to make this definitive. We need to have votes coming in early that show Joe Biden winning. Like, we always say every vote counts. And that's, of course, a way of saying every vote can make the difference, right? Usually that means, like, elections can be close. Your vote can make all the difference, right? It's a little bit of, you know, we play a little bit of a game. This election, truly, every single vote matters because every vote, we don't just need to get to 50 plus one vote, right? We need to actually run up the score. Every vote is a vote against fascism, and every single vote against fascism matters. So, like, I don't care about the polls. We need to run up the fucking score.
All right. On that, thank you, John, for coming on the podcast. We appreciate it.
I got yelling. I got animated.
I know.
Go to VoteSaveAmerica.com. If you are listening to this, if you agree, go to VoteSaveAmerica.com. All right. You can sign up for a volunteer shift. You can donate in some key races. You can fill out your ballot. You can find out how to vote. It's a one-stop shop for everything you need to do. Go to VoteSaveAmerica.com. Pick up a text banking shift. Pick up a phone banking shift, even if you've never done it before. You'll definitely want to say on November 4th that you were part of the movement that helped win. You don't want to wake up having not done enough. Please, please.
John Lovett is a founder of Crooked Media and host of the podcast Love It or Leave It and co-host of Pod Save America.
Learn how you can be part of Vote Save America's efforts to flip the Senate and get out the vote at VoteSaveAmerica.com. They also just launched their ballot guide, which lets you type in your address and pull up everything that's on your ballot and helps you make your voting plan at VoteSaveAmerica.com/ballot.
That's it for this week. Thanks to John Lovett and future Congresswoman Cori Bush. And thank you for being with us as we brought Politically Reactive back. We're back, baby.
We're back with just weeks to go before the huge election. Weeks to wait. We're into weeks now?
Yeah, we're into weeks. New Zealand, call me. And you can have your voices heard as well. Keep tweeting and Facebooking us your comments and questions using the hashtag PoliticallyReactive.
Or leave us a message at 917-477-6525. That's 917-477-6525. Watch my Netflix special, Warn Your Relatives, as well as Kamau's Private School Negro. You can find us both on Twitter and at Instagram, not on TikTok, because we're adults. Also, my documentary Problem with Apu is available on HBO Max.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and WarnerMedia Podcast Network. The executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And me, Hari Kundabolu.
And me, Debbie Kamau Bell.
This show is produced by Matt Martin and Malachi Seeger-Sakir. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. Thanks for listening to Politically Reactive. I've always said that the scariest phone call you can get in America is somebody telling you, Ronan Farrow's on the phone for you. Do you feel that fear?
yeah, I've seen. Well, what's funny is I see him call, like, he'll call a Senate office or something, and he'll say something like, you know, hi, this is Ronan Farrow. I'm not calling about, it's like, he'll have to like, just chill. It's fine. It's about something else. It's not about the boss. It's just a different story. Everybody be cool. Please don't hang up.
I just want to order a pizza. I'm trying to order a pizza.